Well, hello and welcome back to the Archaeology News Weekly. I am your host, David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details in each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. Now, before we go any further, I do actually have to wish us all a happy 5th anniversary. Yes, this podcast news has been going for over 5 years now. So it's thanks to Diego, Dave, and I may as well thank myself as well. And of course, all of you for making this a success that it is. And now, for a special treat, I'm going to try and do a one take. That's right, I'm not going to stop, I'm not going to correct myself. So this is going to be a roller coaster ride. Can I do it? Let's see when we get to the end. But before we get to the end, we have the headlines. And we start with a cairn circle rediscovered in North Yorkshire. Then to a unique Stone Age house and trade goods found in Finland. Their luck is in as a second Venus figurine is found in Orkney. Well, there's more to be found in a dig beneath a 9th century Welsh monument. Life in Bronze Age Lebanon is rediscovered, and back in the UK, Neolithic carvings are discovered in Cambridgeshire. You can now purchase a kit to just see how Neanderthal you are, and more seriously, an unusual broch is investigated in Scotland. Bronze Age skeleton is uncovered in Norfolk, and returning to Orkney, we report on further excavations at a Neolithic burial mound. Prehistoric artefacts are turning blue in Italy, and the search is on for who to blame, which will certainly not be these people, as we hear more about the first Europeans in Bulgaria. Summer drought shows up South Oxfordshire Bronze Age graves, while our last story aims to unearth Tullis Hill's secrets in Scotland. And you're invited to get involved. Well, we've got a bumper crop of stories this week, so let's get started. A cairn circle, which has lain hidden at a place called Snowdon Crags on Asquith Moor in North Yorkshire, has been rediscovered by a group of archaeology enthusiasts led by Mr. Paul Bennett. The ancient site was only mentioned once in the past by a survey of the area more than 60 years ago by Mr. Cowling, where he reported a large circle of heavy material some 30 feet in diameter isolated on the shelf above Snowdon Crags to the west. The Snowdon Crags circle was much overgrown in heather and bracken and was relocated during an exploratory walk by the group of amateur archaeologists. On that day, Miss Douglas stumbled upon an average-sized ring of stones between 1 to 3 feet tall and about 13 yards across, with what seemed like an entrance on its southern side, seemingly untouched in the middle of the mass of decaying bracken. Sounds exciting. A few days later, the group returned to the site, spending a few hours removing dead bracken and carrying it beyond the circle so they could see the monument clearly. This site and the surrounding monuments have received no archaeological attention of any worth. If it wasn't for the fact that the amateurs had explored the moors, this cairn circle would remain unknown. So Mr. Bennett has put up an appeal on his website. That's megalithics, megalithix.wordpress.com, asking for anyone with financial backing who might want to help. Mr. Bennett commented that it would be a good thing to get an archaeologist and a team up there to excavate the place, but it seems nobody has any money for such things. Oh, how true. Well, there are ways, Mr. Bennett. You could, of course, contact HLF Funding, and why not try contacting the local council archaeologist as well? They, I'm sure, will be more than happy to help you try and find some funding. A large terraced house excavated at Järvikkala in Finland has proven to be a treasure trove of history. The design of the structure is similar to ancient dwellings in North Ostrobothnia in Finland and Karelia in Russia, and measures 45 by 20 metres in size. But according to the director of the dig, the structure is exceptional in many regards. From its large size with its three massive rooms, the foundations, each of them are actually larger than a modern cottage. Then there is the material culture remaining associated with the massive house, which is unique. These are trade goods from across the area. The structure dates from between 3,000 to 2,000 years BPE. And look forward to hearing a little bit more about that project. A partner has been found for a rare 4,500-year-old Neolithic figurine discovered at an archaeological dig site on a remote Scottish island. The second carved figure was unearthed just 100 feet from the spot in Westray in Orkney, where the artefact dubbed the Orkney Venus was found last year. The new figurine is headless and made of fired clay rather than sandstone, but archaeologists say it bears a striking resemblance to the original. The Orkney Venus was the earliest carving of a human figure ever found in Scotland, and it's believed both date back to 2600 BCE, when a Neolithic village existed at the dig site at the Links of Notland on the island of Westray. Experts believe that the figurines could have been depictions of deities, and the discovery of a second add weight to the theory that they could have been kept in the home of our early ancestors. The latest find was discovered outside the excavated ruins of a Neolithic house. Two pieces were discovered, which have now been pieced together by specialists. That wouldn't actually be that hard, would it, piecing together two bits? But anyway, let's continue. Without its head, it stands just 1.5 inches tall. A thumb-shaped indentation at the top of the body shows where the head had been attached. Clay balls found near the spot could have been used as heads for the figurines, archaeologists believe. The second figurine has more distinct carvings than the original, probably made by a sharp bone point. A square carving at the front possibly depicts a tunic divided into triangles. A centrally punched hole could easily represent the figure's belly button. It was found by archaeologist Sean Rice, working for Historic Scotland's contractor, Ease Archaeology. The first figurine, known locally as the Westray Wife, has been shortlisted for the Best Discovery in the British Archaeology Awards. It's on display at the Westray Heritage Centre and has already been viewed by more than 100,000 people as part of a special touring exhibition. Historic Scotland hope its new partner will be able to join in on display after further studies have been carried out. Well, just a little bit of extra news there. Sad to say, I'm afraid, it didn't win the British Archaeology Awards. Bad luck there. Archaeologists start excavations on a suspected ancient burial site in Wales to try and understand the significance of the Llangollen landmark on which it stands. But the team will have to work carefully because the 9th century pillar of Eliseg, a Cadw protected ancient monument, stands directly on top of a barrow, a burial mound, and the archaeologists cannot disturb it. Medieval archaeology professor Nancy Edwards from Bangor University says it's the first time the site has been dug since 1773, when it is believed a skeleton was unearthed. They're trying to date the barrow in its broader archaeological context, as the site could date back to the Bronze Age. The history behind the monument and why it was erected on the mound is not yet understood either. However, separate work has been carried out to try and decipher original and additional faded inscriptions by experts from the Royal Commission on the Ancient Historic Monuments of Wales. It was originally a cross made to commemorate an early medieval leader called Eliseg. Today, only the shaft of the cross remains and its inscription, which was already almost illegible when the antiquary Edward Hood tried to describe it in 1696, has disappeared. Joining Professor Edwards on the site for the dig will be colleagues from the University of Chester and with help from Llangollen Museum. The plan is to open one small trench within the barrow and three others in close proximity within the field, which is owned by a private landowner. During the dig, David Crane and Sue Evans from Llangollen Museum plan to give daily updates via the museum's Facebook page, along with members of the dig team. And the public will be allowed on the site during the open day on the 31st of July, between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. The Lebanese site of Tel Fadus Kfar Abida was nearly destroyed by a bulldozer back in 2004. Fortunately, a graduate student from the American University of Beirut spotted pottery shards and the remains of an ancient wall amidst the dirt. This marked the beginning of the dig. And here, under the watchful eye of archaeology professor Herman Gens, who has been overseeing the dig since 2004, students have been excavating for 4 weeks every summer. A treasure trove of artefacts has been unearthed. Tel Fadus Kfar Abida site covers about 1.5 hectares of land and was occupied from around 3000 to 1800 BCE by unknown people of the Bronze Age in what is now known as Lebanon. Tel Fadus Kfar Abida was probably one of the many satellite territories of Byblos, providing the city with goods such as wine, olives and animal products used for consumption and, perhaps more importantly, for trade. Definitive proof of the site's history of regional trade was found when a piece of clay with a lion stamped in it was discovered, a seal which has also been found in items traded around Byblos. Though Tel Fadus Kafarabida was by no means large enough to be an independent political entity, it nevertheless seems to have been much more than a simple coastal village. Three tombs have also been discovered. One of the skeletons was sent back to AUB for closer examination and was found to be a 35-year-old male who probably died of an ear infection. Ouch. Questions still linger over the sudden abandonment of Tel Fadus Kfarabida in 1800 BCE. No direct evidence of armed conflict has so far been found on the site. The fact that there is a fortification system means that warfare was, however, a constant danger. Interestingly, small pots full of food were found lying around, suggesting that the residents of the town left unplanned and in a hurry. It's therefore possible that Tel Fadus Kfarabida had a violent end. A remarkable piece of Neolithic rock art, unlike anything previously found in eastern England, has been unearthed in the Cambridgeshire village of Over. The hand-sized artefact, which could date back to 2,500 BCE, was found by a participant in a geological weekend course, which is being run by the University of Cambridge's Institute for Continuing Education. It consists of a hand-sized slab of weathered sandstone with two pairs of concentric circles etched onto the surface, a motif which, according to the archaeologist, is typical of grooved ware art from the later Neolithic era. This is the first time that any such find has been encountered in eastern England. Unique to eastern England, with its nearest comparable example being the similar scratch patterns on a sandstone plaque from a grooved ware site in Leicestershire. Otherwise, you'd actually have to look as far as Wessex or northern Britain, where there's much more formal megalithic art. The Cambridgeshire Archaeological Unit has been excavating this site within the quarry for 15 years, partly in an effort to better understand the shape and nature of the landscape in prehistoric times. The remains of several settlement clusters from the late Neolithic period have already been found. The Overstone, however, was hidden in the quarry's spoil, one of the heaps of waste geological material discarded by quarry workers. Researchers believe it had been deposited within one of the river's ancient paleo channels crossing the area and that, with the existing information that they have about the geographical layout of the region, the point where it was found can easily be reconstructed. According to latest research, at the time the Overstone was being carved, the countryside would have been dominated by the snaking course of the river, its tributary channels and flooding. This would essentially have broken the area up into a delta-like landscape of small islands, channels and marshlands. In May, scientists finished mapping the genes of the Neanderthal and determined that as much as 4% of those genes are in people today. Now, one company has unveiled a test to determine just how much Neanderthal is inside of you. Well, sort of. The $90 kit from DNA Consultants purports to estimate how much Neanderthal is in your ancestry. It comes up with a Neanderthal index which reports any strong matches you have with populations identified as archaic, thus preserving the earliest earmarks of interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans. But prominent anthropologists are horrified, taking strong issue with the test. "Can you tell I'm disgusted?" writes John Hawkes, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Wisconsin. He noted that the company is perfectly within its rights to sell the kit, since DNA Consultants explain clearly that its product actually doesn't test your genetics. Instead, the product reports on gene variants that we don't know about from Neanderthals. Hawkes continues that you do better putting a caliper on your skull to determine just how Neanderthal you are. Well, I must try giving that a go. Brochs, multi-storied roundhouses, are found across Scotland. They represented a sophisticated understanding of engineering with two thick outer walls separated by an airspace and strengthened with reinforcing lintel slabs. A curious variation, however, on this robust structure has been found in the Cairns, South Ronaldsay in Scotland. The building has walls 5 metres thick and an exterior diameter of 22 metres. The director of the dig, Martin Carruthers, explains that this is just not typical for a broch. What they have is an early broch-like structure, a dominating large construction with thick walls and a very large internal area. In essence, the features are conventional for a broch, but with other features, such as a series of teardrop-shaped cells built into the walls that are not found in Orkney brochs. They can now see how these chambers were weak points in the overall design, and their inclusion meant sections of the roundhouse walls were unable to support the weight of the masonry above them. These architectural problems leave him wondering if this was a period of experimentation. His early attempt at Brock building from the time when the design and tradition surrounding Brock building hadn't quite been finalised or fixed. Pottery from the excavation indicates that it dates from approximately 2,500 years BP, but more extensive dating is underway. The design is similar to Brock's found in nearby Crosskirk in Scotland, where they are believed to date from 3,000 to 2,000 years BP. The Brock and other buildings on the site were probably used for centuries. At some point, this new construction rendered the walls so unstable that the Brock collapsed in on itself. The remains of four Iron Age buildings have been excavated from on top of the original roundhouse. Archaeologists have found two buildings used for metalwork, a living space and a souterrain, which is an underground chamber. Earlier this year, a roofed underground passage was discovered that linked to the original roundhouse entrance. Apparently, even after the collapse, the Brock turns out to have been used as an earth house. The entrance was reinforced with two stone jambs that have supported a door leading to the underground chamber. A bone pommel, perhaps from a sword, was found in this passage. Brocks in the Caithness area are unique in the way that their use evolved over the centuries. In most parts of Scotland, additional buildings were added around the Brock, but this one was left intact. In Caithness, the roundhouses were modified over time as additional constructions were appended to them. Martin Carruthers has proposed that this may have been a way to retain a cultural connection to the original builders of the roundhouses. Excavations at Sedgeford, Norfolk in England have been carried out for some time, and during last year's dig season, a skeleton that was C14 dated placed the site around 2300 BCE. Just when they thought things could not have got better, a second skeleton has now been found. The skeleton is more complete than the first and will hopefully confirm the original findings. Previously, flint tools have been found which had indicated travellers, not settlers. This find might change everything, as only settlers would bury their dead. Excavation of the skeleton has already taken a week and it's expected to continue for a further week. Cause of death is unknown at the moment, but the body is probably that of a male. Excavations were restarted last year at a site at Cantick in South Wales in Orkney. The excavations were led by an Orkney Research Centre for Archaeology and supported by Aberdeen and Durham universities with local volunteers. There's a large burial mound which has been refurbished, maintained and extended over the millennia. Originally started in the Orcadian Neolithic period, but with further work carried out in the Bronze Age, where several box kists were added. A striking feature is a second outer revetment wall, which is square and constructed above the original wall. Fragments of Bronze Age funeral pottery have also been found, and there's evidence of both cremation and inhumation on the site. The second round of excavations had hoped to answer some of the secrets of the mound and plot its history, but unfortunately serious damage has been caused by otters. Yes, I said otters, not others, which had used the mound as a set, and of course, antiquarian treasure hunters. That's possibly one of the first times I've ever seen otters as being listed as archaeological vandals. There you go. Now, archaeological vandalism continues in another strange way in Italy. A number of artefacts ranging from flint tools to Neanderthal bones from around Verona in Italy have begun to turn blue, causing worry and consternation and possibly legal action. The objects were moved from an 18th century castle where overflow from Verona's Natural History Museum was stored to a former arsenal in 2007. The castle was sold by the local authority, but the proceeds of the sale, which were intended to refurbish the arsenal and make it into a suitable home for all the museum's collections, were later reallocated. Laura Longo, the curator of the collection, who noticed the blue phenomena on the flint tools when she visited the relocated artefacts, gave samples to geoarchaeologist Gilberto Artiolo of University of Padua, as well as reporting the problem to Vincenzo Tigni, the area representative of Ministry of Culture in Venice, and others, including the Department for the Police responsible for crimes against cultural heritage. The analysis suggested that hydrocarbons from petrol and weapon lubricants present during the building's use as an arsenal and found in the samples and their packing may have played a crucial role in putting this blue sheen on the artefacts, reacting to form some sort of durable pigment. A petition demanding the immediate relocation of the artefacts is being sent to Italy's cultural minister. It is also calling for an assessment of the damage and an investigation of exactly who is responsible for placing the objects in danger. It may turn out that the arsenal had not been checked for potential pollutants, which may make Verona's local authority culpable under Italy's laws on antiquities. While Town noted that very few of the millions of objects in the collection have been affected and suggest that they can be restored, others are more worried. They've been worried that paleontologists will never be able to do any meaningful analysis from a chemical point of view. It's noted that the more porous bones and pottery will probably be worse affected than the stone objects. DNA analysis of the Neanderthal remains is one method of potentially reconstructing their movements before they died out. And unfortunately, this may be very difficult on the finds that have been affected. Well, it's just another one of these terrible stories where you really wonder what is going on out there. Anyway, on the better side of the news, we have an 8,000-year-old skeleton of a man discovered by archaeologist Gheorghe Gartovski at a site near Ohodin in northwestern Bulgaria. It's on its way now to the Regional History Museum in Hrvats. This is the fourth skeleton so far to be found at the site, and it is the first male. The man, who's been given the name of Hristo, was 165 centimetres tall and died aged around 35. The Bulgarian media has now dubbed him the first European. And Ganatovski, a specialist in Paleolithic settlements who's been investigating the site since 2004, also found a female skeleton that has been named Todorka. He explained the importance of the skeleton, stating that we are now uncovering a so far unknown prehistoric culture in northwestern Bulgaria, which corresponds to the settlements in today's Serbia along the Moravia River. One of the aims of the study is to test the theory about the so-called Danube Road of the spreading of the first settlements with economic production. Hristo and other skeletons will be studied further using DNA and other analytic techniques. The hot, dry weather is revealing some of the Oxfordshire's Bronze Age history normally hidden from view. Hot air balloon pilot Michael Wolfe was training another pilot near North Stoke in Oxfordshire recently when they spotted several dark circles in a farmer's field. Wallenford reported that in 12 years of ballooning, he had never seen anything quite as clear as this. It was like looking on a map. The hot weather must have created absolutely perfect conditions for seeing crop marks. There were 7 or 8 of these big circles. County archaeologist Paul Smith said that there are very extensive areas of Bronze Age barrow cemeteries in the region, as well as some Roman remains. There's a whole mix of multi-period sites. There has not been a lot of excavation, but these sites periodically shows up through crop marks. When it has been dry, the ditches once dug for round barrows hold more moisture than the surrounding area. And then the rest of the field is ripening. The crops above the ditch are considerably greener. This period of the summer is the best time to see crop marks, but it may last just for a few days or perhaps a week. Some summers are definitely better than others, and this year there are lots of sites showing up. The barrows, constructed between 2200 and 1000 BCE, would have once been mounds like the prehistoric Severn Barrow site at Lamborne Downs, near the village of Wantage, but over the centuries farming has all but obliterated surface traces of them. Well, we're nearly there. We're on to the last story now. Ian Sudderby of CFA Archaeology is calling for volunteers to help unearth the secrets of historic site at Tullis Hill in Aberdeen. The area has long been known as an important archaeological site. 4 Bronze Age burial cairns are located there, and a survey in 2004 revealed further evidence of prehistoric activity. More recent structures associated with the 18th and 19th century development of the Tullis House estate are known, and the remains of what are believed to be Aberdeen's last surviving World War II prisoner of war camp were found last year. Until the discovery of this camp, it was believed few archaeological remains survived because of the use of the site as a landfill since the 1970s. Archaeologists now want the public to help search for artefacts which will reveal more of this hill's intriguing past. Judith Stones, Aberdeen City Council Curator of Local History and Archaeology, said, "This was a great opportunity for local people to work alongside professional archaeologists to discover more about the rich historic landscape and for visitors to understand more about the past, present and future of Tullis Hill." Well, volunteers interested in taking part in this dig, which runs until the 21st of July, must contact CFA Archaeology to book a place. And I'm just looking at that just now, and oh, by the time you hear this, unfortunately, your time will be up. So maybe next year. And as ever, I'm going to remind you about Past Horizons. There's going to be quite a lot changing in Past Horizons over the next couple of months. But to see it as it is just now, get yourself along to www.pasthorizons.com. There you'll be able to see about many amazing opportunities to volunteer on archaeological and heritage projects across the world. You'll also be able to read the amazing magazine coming up to its 13th issue just now. And of course, if you're in need of archaeological tools, there's only one place to go, delivering across the world. So it doesn't matter where you are, you need archaeological tools, Past Horizons will help you out. Can I also remind people about my own site, of course, Badger, www.bajr.org, and more, of course, about Stone Pages, news.stonepages.com. Thanks so much for listening to Archaeology News Weekly. It seems I actually did manage to make it all the way to the end with only a few stutters and hideous pronunciations of people's names. So let's see how we do next week, and I hope you'll be there to join me.